Hello and welcome to episode number 28 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Caracino.
Coming to you as usual now in different locations, I'm in Boulevard Park, Washington, home of the Pelton Cast.
I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of your Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks. First of all, how dare you?
You know ID in the town all day. ID in the S E A. You know ID in the town all day. ID in the S E A.
Legitimately got a chat or a question during the chat while we were rewatching the Seahawks game on Sunday from Third Pelton brother Ben Baldwin, echoed by Third Pelton brother Zach Whitman. Are you guys okay?
We have managed to put. Do they not have siblings? They don't have. They're not pairs of brothers, right? At the very least.
I don't know about Zach.
Epic battles happen, and then you just move on the next day.
Brothers fight sometimes, is the way I put it repeatedly on Twitter.
Or maybe you make epic admissions during the Jackbox games and then never speak of it again.
Well, that is an entirely different thing that we have not yet resolved and may resolve in the argument at some point. We called each other on we recorded the pod on Wednesday. We called each other on Thursday afternoon and had a cordial conversation about our agreement to disagree about whether Cam Newton would be a good signing for the Seahawks.
We were like very close to starting a fight again.
I don't think I was that close. I never knocked over my microphone and yelled, "This podcast is over."
You said that you couldn't sleep. You were up until 6 a.m. stewing, just like Cam Newton going through your head.
Not exactly that. 5 a.m. I mean,
5 a.m. I slept like a baby.
I'm sure you did. I was also annoyed that the podcast went as long as I did, and then it did. It's also a good thing that I couldn't sleep, because when I got back up, I realized that I hadn't published the podcast.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, so... You're welcome.
You're so, so angry.
I also, in fairness, took out a few of the profanities. There was a little more cursing in the
Yours
actual...
Yours are mine.
A little from column A and a little from column B.
Oh, my God.
Well, I'm glad, I'm glad that people listened all the way through to that and enjoyed it as much as they did. I feel like the internet agreed with me.
Well, we have managed to reconcile. This isn't like the 2 years that we were feuding with each other and decided not to record this podcast, although it was close.
Yes.
We came close to just ending it all for good.
When I said the podcast was over, I just meant that night's podcast. I was very late. Again, when we finished recording.
Wouldn't that be hilarious if it just went away forever? That was the last line ever on the Pelton Cast. Mic drop, the podcast is over. Maybe you shouldn't even release this right now.
It would have come back. It just wouldn't have been you as the other person.
Just for some reason, Katie is there. No explanation whatsoever. And I'm Katie Caracino.
We never speak of you again.
That's what it would have been. It would have been like, I'm Kevin Dalton, and I'm Katie Caracino, coming to you from Renton, Washington. And then you just would have carried on with the podcast, and everybody liked it more.
I mean, honestly, we could replace either of us with the Ferris Cousin Katie and people would like it more.
Or maybe Mrs. Fantasy Genius. So if you're not doing so right now, from Third Pelton brother Big Paper Daddy on Twitter, he is running the second annual Peltoncast MVP, this one for calendar year 2019, last year.
I think it's more like an NBA thing or an NHL thing where it covers part of 2019 and part of 2020
season.
Yeah.
I guess that is true, because a lot of the segments weren't even in 2019, right? Like, remember some years we weren't doing in 2019, or Coach's Corner, really.
Or Mrs. Fantasy Genius.
So, Mrs. Fantasy Genius, she is never previously on an episode in 2019. Begrudgingly last year to us, the famous Cousin Katie is reigning MVP, and she will again be in the finals, facing off against you and me, and a wild card fourth contender. The finals of that looking like they're going to be Mrs. Fantasy Genius against Ben Baldwin for that fourth slot, and whomever wins that will probably beat all the rest of us.
Except it's going to be Ben, because he's deployed, I should say, his hordes of followers to vote for him.
Well, you have to engage Packers Twitter. That's my advice for Mrs. Fantasy Genius.
So the bracket was number one seed, let's remember some years. Number eight seed was DJ Infrared.
Oh, R.I.P. Infrared. We talked about that last week. Mrs. Friends. Fantasy Genius is wearing some sort of complicated foot things. What are these called?
It's a Korean baby feet foot mask.
Right now. And she's going to tweet when she's facing off with Ben tomorrow. Aaron Rodgers still got it. Aaron Rodgers, MVP 2020.
So also on that side of the bracket was the four seed, the Pelton Cast Hall of Fame, which was swamped by third Pelton brother Ben Baldwin in the first round. Then Ben went on to defeat, let's remember some years, in one of the semifinals. The other side of the bracket, the two seed Coach's Corner, defeated Chris Smith before losing to Mrs. Fantasy Genius, who was the sixth seed, but knocked off Teriyaki in the round.
A lot closer against Teriyaki than Coach's Corner.
Yeah.
But I mean, I don't know. I guess I'd probably choose Teriyaki over Coach's Corner.
I've never eaten Coach's Corner, so. So it'll be between the two of them. Be sure to cast your vote on Tuesday to pick the fourth person in that poll. And then hopefully we'll have a longer poll for the actual PeltonCast MVP between, again, us, the famous Cousin Katie.
This is all Big Paper Daddy. Again,
this is just a suggestion.
This is not officially... Go ahead.
We're acknowledging it.
No, it's officially licensed, but this is not happening via the PeltonCast. There's no PeltonCast bias happening here. We're not influencing what's going on.
I mean, we could probably influence what's going on. That's @_big_paper_daddy. In the off chance that you are not yet following Kevin Calla.
For one, Tristan Carcino, when you're voting in the finals, have integrity about these sorts of things. Remember that Kevin Pelton said that he could influence this sort of thing.
I'm just saying we could. I'm not saying I am. Like, we're
drunk
voting ourselves.
Drunk with power is what
you're
saying.
Actually drunk with Sergio, but that's a different story entirely.
Wow. Anyway, so go ahead and vote on that when that comes out. You said you're drunk with Sergio. Is that what you're drinking tonight?
No, I finished that off earlier when I was having Baka Baka for dinner. I did.
The whole movie? Wow.
Yeah.
That's a lot of soju.
It was a good amount of soju. I did not anticipate at that point that we were going to pod tonight. But I'm good. I'm good.
Okay.
For the pod, I am drinking, as when this is released, it will be Cinco de Mayo. I am drinking Pacifico in a can.
Oh, there you go.
Which is unusual, but they were out of bottles at Fred Meyer.
I'm drinking a beer that we're going to have to pour one out because of. And that is, it tastes like 2003 Pyramid Hefeweizen. Taking it back to the old school of beer I've not had in quite a long time. But I'm drinking it here today because a fixture of the Soto area, the Pyramid Brew House or Pyramid Ale House, that stood directly across from Safeco Field was a hub before Mariners games, Sounders games, Seahawks games. You know, every sort of sporting event that could have happened down there. It was a packed place, concerts. I mean, I've met so many people there and had a beer in that outdoor beer garden at Pyramid Ale House. And they announced this week that they're going to be closing forever.
Yeah, it's funny. I completely randomly, while doing some research for Let's Remember Some Years, came across an email with a friend where I was meeting them at the Pyramid Ale House before a Sounders game.
Really?
Yep. So that is disappointing. I remember we watched one Husky game there and hung out.
Yep.
That was a good time. So, yeah, definitely. I mean, Pyramid, we've talked about it before in the pod, a gateway craft beer for us. And
absolutely.
The Pyramid Hefeweizen in particular.
It's Pyramid and Red Hook are like our parents' craft beer.
There was a discussion that came up with a group earlier tonight about how in Last Dance – they're always drinking cheap domestic beer.
Miller Lite, yeah.
Yeah, and it's like, that's all that existed back then. Now, they could have been, I don't know if we ever figured out what the Chicago, we did, someone tweeted to us.
It's called Old Style.
Okay. They could have been drinking that. That would have been a much cooler thing to drink, but it's completely understandable.
That's not a Michael Jordan beer. Michael Jordan was not drinking. I mean, this is no offense to the GOAT, but he was not drinking Old Style. He's a Miller Lite kind of guy. Yeah. I mean, this is the man who really like set the tone for modern marketing.
Right, he was not exactly indie.
Yeah, that's Michael Jordan, not exactly indie. I mean, as far as I understand, I think it was an indie choice to sign Nike.
It sort of was, yes. It was described on The Last Dance in episode 5. But yeah, definitely a disappointing news. I mean, Pyramid will continue to exist, right? You're just not going to have the Ale House open.
Yes, and not have that same kind of hub prior to sporting events to meet. I mean, there's still plenty of other options, but it definitely was like it was the meeting place. That outdoor patio.
Yeah.
So
very disappointing. So we'll pour some out and also toast to Pyramid on this one. I thought at the top here, though, we should discuss some happier Seahawks news.
Hello.
Something that we all can get behind. Well, yeah, it's not really news. It's just an update, I guess. And sadly, it's not about Jadeveon Clowney, who probably will not sign for several months here. But Marshawn Lynch on SportsCenter with Scott Van Pelt on Monday night tells him that his agent, Doug Hendrickson, has been in talks with Seattle. Marshawn's quote, "Like I said, we'll see what happens. If it works out and I get back up there, it is what it is. And if not, shit, I'm looking good. So I ain't really tripping too much."
He said this on ESPN.
That's how it's quoted in the ESPN story. I didn't see the actual segment.
What a legend. Oh my God.
Yeah. We really thought we'd see the last.
For the content, at the very least.
We also talked last week about how spots on the roster at running back may be hard to come by with them drafting DJ Dallas in the fourth round, depending on, you know, how quickly Rashad Penny and Chris Carson are able to return from their injuries. But Marshawn could be in the mix.
we don't need DJ Dallas. Come on, give us Marshawn. Who needs DJ Dallas at this point? Is he any different than a seventh round running back?
I just don't think we can bring him in because there will be too many questions about whether Chris Carson and Rashad Penny are going to start.
I mean, it would be, I do have to say, unless he was taking sort of like a hybrid coach role, having Marshawn on your roster and having him as like your fourth running back, like that probably would create some issues. If the beast is getting zero carries a game, or if there's a goal line situation and you don't give him the ball all of a sudden, then that's going to be a problem. But you know what? That's a problem I want to have. That's the kind of controversy that we need in this locker room.
I mean, I look back on the signing of Marshawn as one of the happiest moments of last season.
Absolutely. It's more the reason we pay attention to sport is to have fun. Right? This isn't serious. You know, we're not talking about
international politics here. We're not getting in blood feuds with our brother over this.
This is having Marshawn Lynch on your roster. It's worth a roster spot just to have a good time. To have Marshawn Lynch in camp.
Did you catch any of the replay on ESPN tonight of the quote-unquote Fail Mary game?
No, I've never heard of such a game.
Me neither. I watched
the Seahawks' comfortable Monday night football victory over the Green Bay Packers.
Let's go with come from behind. I watched the entirety of it, although without audio, because I was on a series of like happy hour / Zoom chats, and Marshawn was out there beasting a little bit. It was good to see young Marshawn.
That game was definitely up there with the most fun games that I've ever been to. Chris and I, because it was September, and it was really nice. I took the day off work. We went down on 3rd Avenue.
I was there. I tailgated with you guys.
For various times, right?
I don't think that is true. No, you're thinking of, you know what you're thinking of? You're thinking of the game after they won the Super Bowl. The Thursday night game to start the season. Yeah, you are.
No, I'm not. This was the Monday night football game. I am not thinking of the Thursday night game.
I remember meeting you there. I don't know. Well, I wasn't in and out, that's for sure.
Okay, maybe you met us there. I was there like 10 a.m. It was a sunny day. It was hot.
And it was like 10 a.m. until the game started. We were in Third Avenue drinking the entire day.
Yeah,
and then I was shocked. Funny. We got in the stadium, and it was the most opposing fans I've ever seen before.
Was this a game where you, like, almost got in a fight with Packers fan?
No, I mean, not really. So, the touchdown happens, clear catch, and we see the arms go up, and we're just losing our shit celebrating. And then, like, as everybody calmed down, there was a Packers fan in front of us who were fine, or whatever, and he was like, apparently thought that I had kicked him in celebration, which might have happened, but there was nothing malicious going on. It was just we'd all lost our minds because of this insane play.
You were not socially distancing at that point.
No. We were doing quite the opposite. And so he was like, you kicked me over. And I was like, I'm so sorry.
It was not actually an almost fight.
No. There was nothing.
Okay, but we're not here to remember 2012, as much fun as that will be when we get to that, and let's remember some years. It's time instead for that segment presented by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza on 2008.
Because Pagliacci is the bright spot of 2008, and so is bringing back the Sounders, or bringing the Sounders for the first time.
I mean, it's sort of bringing them back to first division soccer, I guess, but we'll get to that in a second here. My suggestion for that was because Pagliacci doesn't want to be associated with Seattle Sports in 2008, and neither do we. A quick shout out to our friends at Pagliacci who are now offering Rachel's ginger beer bottles in their stores. So
wow.
You can pick those up while you're getting your takeout Pagliacci or order them with your delivery. That's very exciting.
There we go.
2008 is without question the worst year in Seattle sports history.
Wow.
I mean, it's not even close. Like, 2008 was so miserable a year in Seattle sports. It was somehow worse than 2020, where all the sports are going to get canceled.
No, best case scenario, the sports got canceled in 2008.
Just strictly in a sports context, obviously, the other effects of the pandemic, way worse in a real life sense. But highlighted by the Sonics' move to Oklahoma City. The 2007-08, as we mentioned last week, was Kevin Durant's rookie season, which was overshadowed by the looming possibility of a move and also how bad the team was. They started 0-8 before back-to-back wins at Miami and Atlanta, the latter in double overtime, coming on to the first career game-winning shot for Kevin Durant. Then the Sonics lost another 6 in a row. They were actually kind of competitive in December before beginning a 14-game losing streak. This was really not a fun season to cover for Supersonics.com. At the deadline, they traded Wally Szczerbiak, Kurt Thomas, and Delonte West, three of their veterans, then lost 20 of their next 22, or 20 of their 22 in one stretch, including a 168-116 loss to the Denver Nuggets. They did get two strong wins to finish out the home schedule, 151-147 over Denver in double overtime, and then 99-95 over Dallas in the last game in Seattle, a game I did an entire podcast about a couple of years ago on the 10th anniversary of. And we didn't know it at the time that was the last game necessarily. Durant was named Rookie of the Year, but again, overshadowing everything was the possibility of the move. At the All-Star game, at his annual press conference, David Stern called the move, quote, an inevitability.
Oh, God.
We did have some hope in April when the previous ownership group filed a lawsuit based on the good faith, best effort clause of the sale agreement, trying to get that deal rescinded. But then came the trial with the city of Seattle over the Key Arena lease, which ran from June 16th through June 26th. The ruling was set for July 2nd. But that was preempted by news of a settlement between the city and the team allowing the Sonics to move to Oklahoma City. But we sure did get the rights to maybe get the name.
There we go. That's huge.
Yeah. I mean, should we go over the day of the sale? We've talked about that before, including on the 10th anniversary. We did a podcast with Jake. The day of the move, yes.
Sure.
So I found out a couple hours beforehand, and then I had to put the press release on the website, which,
wow,
single toughest part of my time at the Sonics. And then we all went to Kell's, and there was an open tab, so that was quite an evening.
Who paid the tab? The Sonics.
The Sonics paid the tab, to their credit.
Clay Bennett
paid that tab.
You should have run up like a $150 million tab. just to see what happened. So this was an epic night of drinking for you?
Not necessarily for me, but it was an epic night of drinking overall.
This was not like you're puking when Sean Kemp brought you a shot night?
It was not like that, no. I remember this night, for one thing.
I didn't sleep on your doorstep.
I did not.
For much of the organization, was that the case, though?
Yeah, solid percentage, I would say.
I mean, the team moving, I want to hear about a pretty epic drunk. So then you went home, and that was that?
Well, you were in Renton, right?
No, I'm just saying, then you went home, and then the team was gone. Like, you just didn't go to work the next day, or?
No, I mean, first
off, were you still going because of storm duties, or?
Yeah, I mean, the move didn't, it took a long period of time. They didn't completely move the Sonics organization until, bless you, probably September, I think. It was a weird summer in the office because just slowly there were fewer and fewer people as, you know, various people got their offers to relocate from the team and either decided to take those or not and to leave the organization. And so it was mostly those of us who were still working on storm stuff and just a handful of like Sonic specific people. It just kept dwindling over the course of that summer until it was just the storm folks left before we moved to the Furtado Center, the old practice facility, which was our temporary HQ in that fall. But I mean, the story I've told about, so the next night the storm had a home game. The move is July 2nd. There's the 4th of July is coming up. In between, the storm plays a home game. And so, like, it had been a long night and probably got to the office a little late the next day. But go to the game that night, and I went into the WNBA president was in town at the time. And, like, I knew her a little bit from interviewing her for the Storm website, doing some videos. And, you know, she says to me in one of the back hallways, "How's it going?" And I'm like, you know, about as good as can be expected, referencing the move. And at that point, the slogan of the league was, as she says, "We expect great." And that was not the time for it. Not the time.
She actually responded to you, "We expect great."
Yep. Yep.
Wow. I expected great from you even that moment. Oh, man. It's funny because I remember, basically, I knew the team was moving. You always had that, like, nibble of hope, though. And as we've discussed many, many times in this podcast, that hope is, of course, a bad thing.
The worst of things.
And that little, I was just like, this lawsuit is going to go through, you know, because I was dumb. And
I mean, I thought I that like, too. I thought that there were going to be two lame duck seasons and that they were going to be just really miserable. Like, I thought it might be my last game working for the Sonics at Key Arena. I didn't think it was going to be the last game at Key Arena.
I mean, we've talked about this before, but I still firmly believe if they would have had those two seasons, I think the whole world looks different long term. And I don't know if David Stern would have been stoked to have 2 years of a lame duck team in Seattle, especially as they're getting much better.
I mean, the other thing that changed was, of course, the recession at that point.
Yes. When on the court, I mean, outside of the team moving, one of the worst things that happened in 2008 was that there was a coach who saw Kevin Durant as a 6'8" player, maybe one of the most versatile players to come into the league ever at the time. And there was a coach out there who saw him and said, "That guy is a shooting guard."
I mean, I will always defend PJ on this. I find it kind of ridiculous. Like, Kevin Durant and Damian Wilkins were the starting wings. In Seattle, they called Kevin Durant the shooting guard. in Oklahoma City, they started the same two guys, and they called Damian Wilkins the shooting guard. Like, it's a meaningless distinction. Now, what was meaningful is they were starting the two of them with Chris Wilcox, or maybe Nick Collison. I can't even remember. Nick might have been at center by that point, but they had, like, two non-shooters in the front court, whereas in Oklahoma City, they played Jeff Green at power forward, so it was a more modern lineup from that standpoint. But I think that whole, like, he's a shooting guard thing is overplayed. Although, you know who disagrees with me? It's Kevin Durant. Kevin Durant.
Yeah.
We definitely wanted PJ Collison about fired.
Anyway, the team moved. It was just, like, I felt like there was a very good chance of the lawsuit going through, and I think that's why it hurt. Because it wasn't like this, it was something acting for a long time. Obviously, we weren't stupid. But it was just like we were still holding out this kernel of hope, and then that was taken away from us. You hear the press conference, you hear people who previously were like staunchly in the Stave Arsonics group all of a sudden changing their tune and thinking that this is a good deal or whatever. And you're like, oh, it's over. Fuck. You know, just that last little bit of the rug being pulled out from under you in a year and a half or whatever, where it was just happening constantly. There was no good news. You see the vote come up over the league meetings, and you're like, okay, it was a 29-2 vote, 28-2 vote?
I think it might have been 27-2. I think someone might have abstained. But yeah, it was definitely the only two votes against were Mark Cuban and Paul Allen.
And I always, always will respect those owners for doing that. You know, like, Paul Allen makes so much sense having the ties to Seattle, but Mark Cuban is somebody who instantly earned so much respect and really foresight, too, of saying maybe our teams shouldn't be in tiny markets. And you look at the NBA now, and I bet the NBA, if they could just redraw where all the teams were, they would do it differently. And maybe Mark Cuban was somebody who was wise enough to have seen that. But definitely respected Mark Cuban, and then of course Paul Allen for standing on the side of Seattle in that situation in the Northwest. But this moment where it's just like it hurt so much more than you thought it would when you'd been through all this, and it just being like, oh shit, it's done. And then the team was moved pretty much instantly after that. So I went home to Renton. I was at work, and I just left. I was like, I gotta go. Nobody at the Vera Project where I was working at the time knew even the slightest bit about what was going on. It wasn't
even
like
you guys were
I could
so
talk
close to Key Arena.
Yeah, it's like I remember talking about it on there are these little benches in the corridor that's right outside of KXP now. You're looking at Key Arena, and I'm like on the phone talking about the team moving, maybe to you, I don't even know. And then it was just like, I'm looking at this building that I've been to hundreds of times to see this team play. It's basically like, I feel like we like grew up at Seattle Center because we were there so often for all sorts of various things. But it was like Seattle Center was home in a lot of different ways. And then it's just over. So I was like,
you never went back to Seattle Center again.
Yeah, I did not constantly find myself there. But including working there every single day for the next 7 years. But then I was just like, I gotta go to everybody. It was not a moment of like, hey, this thing happened. Just like, I gotta go. I got myself a 40 of Old English and I went to my house in Renton. I drank the 40 and then I just passed out alone. And I was like, this is what I need right now. I was like, I need to be alone in my misery. And then I woke up.
Yeah, go.
Well, I woke up the next day and it was like, this is over. This is the new world that we need. It was like you get a day to be miserable, and then it's like, this is the new world. The one that really hit was about 3 weeks later or whatever, I was walking around the Capitol Block Party grounds. We'll talk about Block Party in a second. My favorite time of being involved in a music festival is the like couple hours before doors open. If you're working on it, you're just like walking around. The grounds are being built. There's all this like steam and excitement. It's July. You know, so many people are going to be here in just a couple of hours. It's going to be so much fun. And looking at a Seattle Times from like a newsstand outside of Cafe Vita. And it was like, you know, Oklahoma City team has a name, Thunder. And I was just like, fuck them. just like reading that on the newspaper, because I was so tuned out to what was going on, and I was just like, God damn it. That made it feel almost as real as that day. Like, I will never forget that moment.
I mean, the ironic thing in hindsight about the day the Sonics moved is there was a thunderstorm in Seattle, so you almost never have in July.
Cool. Love that synergy.
All right, let's talk about some other bad shit that happened.
2008.
Do you know football?
Oh.
So, we're pretty excited after that Jake Locker freshman season, feeling good about things. They open the season against number 21 Oregon on the road and lose 44-10. Okay, fine.
I mean, August 30th, I believe, was the date of that game. Like, how do you schedule that? Scheduling was insane around this time.
Yes. The Huskies were badly overscheduled, because check out their next two games after playing number 21 Oregon at number 21 Oregon. They then came back home to take on BYU, which was ranked at the time 15th in the country. And so Jake Locker scores a touchdown right at the end of regulation that seemingly ties that game. But he gets called for a celebration penalty for throwing the football in the air. That moves the extra point back. It gets blocked. They lose 28-27.
I kick a garbage can.
That is correct.
That was the worst penalty in the history of sports.
I'm sure there have been worse penalties.
In fact, I'm going to go pull it up right now. 28-21. Oh, Jake on the keeper. Running it in. Escapes tacklers. He's in. Touchdown. Flips the ball in the air. I mean, he threw it up high. How do you call that?
Yeah, it was nothing gratuitous.
A penalty there. Like, it was not taunting. He didn't throw it at a player, right? He didn't throw it, like, if he throws it in the face of a BYU player, that's one thing. This was just him being excited.
Hope is a bad thing. Maybe the worst of things.
I am still so upset watching this play. God, I fucking hate Pac-12 refs.
I guess that
or
was.
College refs. It doesn't matter. They're bad all across. And then Jake goes, he has to go in that moment. He's so excited, right? He just makes this play where he's evading tacklers. He almost gets brought down, which might have ended the game. And then gets in, flips the ball in the air. It's harmless, right? It's not even in the direction even – like, how do you process that as a – I clearly am not over this. How do you process that as a referee when you're looking at that and be like, oh, could that be a penalty? It didn't even cross our minds.
Even national coordinator for college football officiating David Perry conceded, I think it's safe to say on emotional moments, officials might become a little more lenient. BYU coach Bronco Mendenhall on Monday reiterated his stance on the call, saying the officials called the play by the rules.
Of course.
BYU still filled three spots in the AP poll. That's funny. Oh, the rules exist to teach principles of class and integrity.
Oh, my God. I fucking hate the NCAA.
So the next week,
I hope Bronco Mendenhall is happy as the head coach of Virginia with an under 500 record in the ACC.
He's probably doing fine.
I'm sure he is. He's probably pretty convinced there'll be a season this year.
So the schedule lightened up the next week. Was number three Oklahoma and Sam Bradford came to town.
Oh my God! I remember that game.
So I remember, like, I was going to go to the Storm game the next day in LA. I decided to travel day of. I flew down to LA and back all in the same day and covered a game because of the fact that I wanted to stay home to go to this Oklahoma game. And then the Huskies lost 55-14.
I mean, that was number one pick in the draft, Sam Bradford. Like,
it was an honor just to be on the same field. No, they weren't even the best team UW played that year. It was a very hard schedule.
Well, Oklahoma really has had a lot of number one pick quarterbacks. That's three in, like, the last two decades.
Yeah. So then the next games, they're 0-3, but they've played three ranked teams so far and probably should have at least gone to overtime against one of them. And then game four, Jake Locker breaks his thumb and is lost for the season. His backup, Ronnie Fauch, completed 45% of his passes with 13 interceptions against just four touchdowns.
This is one of those situations where I think it would have made sense to pay Cam Newton.
The firing of Tyrone Willingham was announced after the first 7 losses for the Huskies. After a narrow 35-28 loss in that Stanford game, Game 4, their only loss by fewer than 20 points was the Apple Cup against a 1-10 Wazoo, which the Huskies lost 16-13 in overtime. They then
was that the
this...
one that they had the – did Lewis Rankin return, or is that later?
I'm not sure. What do you
Lewis Rankin return a kick for a touchdown? I think that must have been later.
There was only one touchdown, so no, it was not that. Willie Griffin, who is someone that I have no memory of. People named Willie Griffin and Terrence Daly combined for over 200 rushing yards for the Huskies on 46 carries in that game, because that's how little they trusted Ronnie Fouch, who threw 16 passes. And I have no idea who either of those people are anymore. This is gone. I've just erased all memory of that. He finished the season with a 48-7 loss at Cal, with Javid Best running for 311 yards and 4 touchdowns.
Oh, man, Javid Best. Oh, he was awesome. There was like a long line of really fun Cal running backs.
Oh, yeah. Justin Forsett. I think he was the year before.
Bring him all into camp for the Seahawks.
Agreed. So the Seahawks reached the end of their run after winning the NFC
really,
West.
Really quick on the Huskies before we get there.
When
any of these fuckers complain about Coach Pete or Husky football,
or
right
about
now,
how like they're not competitive enough in the big games.
After going to the College Football Playoff, playing in the Peach Bowl, after going to the Fiesta Bowl, and then playing in the Rose Bowl in 3 consecutive years. And they have one mildly down season, and people were complaining about UW football. You fuckers were not there with us in 2008 in the stands all alone. There were so many times in that student section where we had an entire section to ourselves. Or it was like
I don't know if it was an entire section.
It was the section just to the left, because the student section was on the side at the time, and we would be just to the left of it because we had end zone tickets and we would walk over there. And there were times that there was like maybe 2 other people. But we were there for every single one of these goddamn games of the 2000 season. We deserve everything that could possibly come to us after that. If you have suffered through 2008, you get to enjoy all of the fruits of everything that happened after. And you cannot complain about Coach Pete and going to 3 consecutive BCS games.
Agreed. Also, the Huskies lost 56-0 to Cal that year.
Wow.
Shouts to Pete Carroll. So the Seahawks.
To USC, you mean?
what did I say?
Cal.
Oh, to Cal, yeah, to USC. We already talked about the Cal game. The Seahawks reached the end of their run after winning the NFC West 4 consecutive years. They went 4-12 in Mike Holmgren's final season as head coach, starting the season 1-5, and never really competitive. Matt Hasselbeck was limited to 7 games by multiple injuries. His backup, Seneca Wallace, actually played reasonably well in his stead, but the defense was 27th in DVOA. Julius Jones replaced Sean Alexander at running back. And,
oh, God, the Julius Jones era.
The main thing I remember about that season is playing at Dallas on Thanksgiving and just like not even being excited about the idea of playing
on
Thanksgiving.
They had MB3, right? Dallas.
Marion Barber?
Yeah, Marion Barber III. Who is like a thrilling player for like a season. There was that Minnesota running back factory that he came from.
Yes, he had 10 carries for 32 yards in that game.
There
thrilling.
We go. Thrilling. It is weird that the Seahawks played. I think there were a couple games that they played on Thanksgiving during this period where they're just not. Was this the only one, or was there a second?
No, I think there was a second. I think you're correct, but I don't know what year the other one was.
And they just didn't even really register for us, right? It's kind of insane how different that is from eventually Richard Sherman eating turkey legs on the 49ers field and like maybe the greatest moment of Seahawks history happening on Thanksgiving. But this was a time where it's just like, oh yeah, the Seahawks are on. It's Thanksgiving, the Seahawks are on, whatever.
We have to ignore this.
It's kind of crazy how different that is from modern times. But yeah, I mean, the bottom fell out of the Seahawks quite quickly. And for the Holmgren era, it was clear that that era was over. And, you know, Haas stuck around for another season after that, or I guess another
seasons after that.
And I think he had some okay times, but it was like, this regime was over in Matt Hasselbeck's tenure as like a Super Bowl competing quarterback was definitely done.
Yeah.
And then we get the Jim Mora year. So,
well, we're going to get to that.
The good news is they drafted Aaron Curry with the fourth pick that year.
Yes, that was the fruit of their last season. That was the only Thanksgiving game at Dallas, it appears. At least in
we
the
both remember
era,
a second game. There's some sort of Mandela effect of a second Thanksgiving game.
The other times they played at Thanksgiving at Dallas, 1980 and 1986, which, believe it or not, I do not remember those two games.
Wow. Really makes you think.
UW men's basketball missed the NCAA tournament for a second consecutive season. This time it was their first sub-500 finish since Lorenzo Romar's first season on Montlake. They went 7-11 in Pac-10 play with Ryan Appleby as their second leading scorer.
Man.
Huskies did manage to beat number 5 UCLA at home when Tim Morris threw the ball off Alfred Aboya's face late in the game to avoid a 5-second count.
I was in a class with Tim Morris in college in 2007.
UCLA reached the Final Four that year and lost just 4 games, went 35-4, so that was something. I was only reminded of this game because I was going back through my Facebook posts, and Katie posted, "What a game!" after that one, or something like that.
This was like a classic early social media, just no context whatsoever.
Exactly. Yeah, the best. So I had to look it up. Like, I wasn't sure. And I was like, oh, yeah, you know what? That was a pretty good game.
What a...
I mean, it was weird because there was, like, such a controversy about, like, was it unethical for Tim Morris to throw the ball off Alfred Aboya's face? Like, what a weird year in college sports that the big problems were Jake Locker threw the ball in the air and Tim Morris not, like, unsportsmanlike. He was just like trying to win the game, threw the ball off Alfred Aboya's face. Like, yeah, ideally you should definitely not do that, but like,
it was,
let's all chill out.
Him doing that was a lot more egregious than Jake Locker. Like, as far as disrespecting your opponents, that's a lot worse than Jake Locker flipping the ball in the air.
I mean, it was worse, but I don't think it was like, it wasn't again like he was angry at Alfred Aboya. It was just like he ran out of time and he couldn't think of anything else, so he just threw it directly at him. Like, it was bad, but I don't think it was that bad. Anyways, the Huskies, so they were so upset about getting snubbed from the NIT.
He just learned nothing from me in that romantic literature class that we took together.
The Huskies were so upset the previous year that they got snubbed from the NIT that they helped create, like, their anger was behind, helped part behind the creation of the College Basketball Invitational, the CBI, and they then played in.
Is there any more Husky basketball situation than to be angry about being snubbed from the NIT that you create some other bullshit tournament to go to that isn't the NCAA tournament?
They played in the inaugural CBI the next year. And then they lost at home 72-71 to Valpo.
Oh, and then not taking it seriously. That's like the most Husky basketball situation of all time, is to be so angry that you're snubbed by the NCAA tournament that you create some bullshit tournament because you're offended, and then you don't take that tournament seriously when you do play in it.
I mean, they should have made the NIT the year before, but that year, that was a low point for a period of time in UW men's basketball. Because
like if they won the NIT, we'd be looking back and that year is still a bad year of Husky basketball.
I don't know if I go that far. So the Seattle Mariners also regressed badly after their promising above 500 2007. They got excited. They knew they were close to contending. So they traded a group of players, including future 5-time All-Star Adam Jones, 2008 All-Star closer George Sherrill, and eventual All-Star starting pitcher Chris Tillman to Baltimore for Eric Bedard, who got the opening day start. Bedard was limited to 15 starts by injury, and the offense collapsed as the Mariners lost 101 games.
I do remember, I think I was reading some sort of sports preview before this year, because I wasn't paying attention to the Mariners, but I might have been playing fantasy baseball, I want to say, in 2008, and just like reading a thing and being like, the Mariners... And a prediction that the Mariners were going to win the AL West. It was went all in on Eric Bedard. And I think Eric Bedard was actually quite a good player, but was just never healthy.
He was a good player. I don't know if I would say he was quite a good player.
That, wow. You remember they went all Cliff Lee trade? Was that the next year? The Mariners really have a history of, like, going all in on situations when they're nowhere near the playoffs.
Yeah, because they, like, had a long stretch where it was, like, one year they would be above 500, and it's promising. Things are looking up. And then the next year they would lose 100 games.
Man, Randy Messenger. Have you ever heard of that person? He sounds more like an 80s baseball player than anybody on this roster.
That is correct, but
Randy Messenger sounds like he was like 6-10 for the Tigers in like 1987.
I know. I feel like Randy Messenger played in an 80s band.
Randy Messenger?
Yeah, he maybe played the guitar.
He was in the Replacements, or you think he was in more of a dance band?
More of a dance band.
Man, this team was bad.
So in somewhat happier news, the 2008 Seattle Storm. First off, they were still in Seattle. Sale of the team to a group of local women calling themselves Force 10 Hoops, which continue to own the team today. It was announced on January 8th. A day later, they announced Brian Egler is the team's new head coach. A wild offseason saw the Storm's trade for Swing Cash, followed by the signings of free agents Cheryl Swoops and Yolanda Griffith, giving the team 5 All-Stars and 3 MVPs. And what we called the perfect storm.
Oh, God. That's because you got a marketing degree.
I did not. I've been involved in some of those. I don't think perfect storm was my suggestion, although I didn't enjoy it. They started
2009
slowly.
2009 season, Eric Bedard, 2.82 ERA in 15 starts. He was really good. 1.1 whip. Eric Bedard is good. I mean, if he was healthy, he could never pitch past 5 innings, of course. If Eric Bedard was healthy, he was a very good pitcher.
He was 5th in the Cy Young voting in 2007.
Yeah, he was always injured. Anyway, back to your stroke of marketing genius, the perfect storm, you said?
I don't know if you heard, there was a movie. It started slowly before a 7-game winning streak.
The second that movie came out, there was like a clock went up on the wall to when the Storm were going to use that in advertising.
Okay, so here's the thing. The thing that really stands out to me about that offseason is like, this is the royal we. Like, internally there was a list of like all the reasons that people didn't buy tickets. So it's like, we're upset that the team is going to move to Oklahoma City. We don't like the head coach. We want more star players. It's like, look, we answered all of these things in one offseason. Like, literally everything you could have been unhappy about changed. So it was a great time from that standpoint.
Did the ticket sales go way up because of that?
They went up. I don't know if I'd say they went way up.
They stayed the same. People don't actually care about those things when they answer the questions.
Oh, I mean, that is true. But they did go up. Like, people were excited about the team. Like, they added 2 MVPs and another Hall of Famer in all likelihood in the same offseason. It's, like, epic. Started slowly before a 7-game winning streak in early July. Lauren Jackson was injured in the Olympics representing Australia, which lost in the gold medal game to the U.S. and former Storm coach Ann Donovan, as well as Sue Bird. And I think Swing Cash might have also been on that team, too. Was unable to return after the break. Bird took over as the team's leading scorer, and that, along with elite defense, helped the Storm to a franchise record 22 wins. But with Cash also ailing, she'd undergo back surgery after the season. The Storm lost to the Sparks in 3 games in the first round. Their 4th consecutive first-round exit.
Well, at least the Storm trading for Swing Cash set up your greatest sports achievement ever in her drafting you in a pickup basketball game.
No, that was Cheryl Swoops. It was a nice try, but it's Cheryl Swoops.
It was Cheryl Swoops. Well, either way, right? A player that they acquired in 2008. I thought it was Swing Cash.
No, it wasn't Swing.
Cheryl Swoops is even more legendary, right?
I mean, yes. She's one of the greatest players in women's basketball history. So
there you go.
About it.
I've never been drafted and picked up by one of the greatest basketball players in women's basketball history. As far as I know.
I can confirm.
I don't think. No.
Yeah, she never won WNBA MVP a single time. And Cheryl
Pelton
did
Cast
it,
MVP. Pelton Cast MVP.
Yeah, that's true.
Call me when Cheryl wins one of those.
We'll have to get her on the pod. Okay, so you mentioned it earlier. The Seattle Sounders FC continuing to move towards becoming an expansion franchise in 2009. So the big furor early in 2008 was an initial pull to name the team that did not include the Sounders is an option, the name that had been used here going back to the NASL in the 1970s, and then also was being used for the minor league USL team that was playing before the Sounders moved up to the MLS. Then they announced Sounders FC is a compromise choice after an overwhelming number of responses to that poll used Sounders as a running dog.
Yes.
And my conspiracy theory is they wanted to name it the Sounders FC all the time, but they wanted people to get upset about it to generate excitement. That's just like a part of me will always believe they did that strategically.
That did not. That is putting way too much credit in sports marketing individuals.
They had to know if people wanted the team to be named the Sounders. Everyone knew that.
Let me give you a counterpoint to just let you understand what the level of marketing for people who are working in sports is.
This is going to be
the perfect storm.
Look, it was a really cool photo of all the starters together that I used on the website a lot.
What year do you think that movie came out?
2003?
The year 2000. You were only 8 years behind. you're like, we have to capitalize on this. It's okay, the book only came out in 1997, so.
Well, most people were waiting for the movie.
The perfect storm.
The first Sounding.
No, they probably had the idea to do this, to do the old okey-doke with the with the name.
I mean, they just can't have been caught off guard by it.
The most obvious thing that you can. This is all marketing, but. Nobody is that – like this is the problem that people who believe in conspiracies don't understand is that most people are dumb. And you should just assume the most obvious thing. There has to be some sort of – is this Occam's razor?
That is Occam's razor, yes.
There you go. Boom. Called it.
I feel like in this case Occam's razor is like not including it as a choice as compared to like Seattle FC was one of the choices. Like obviously that was an extremely boring name.
But a lot of teams have been named that since then.
True. But those teams didn't necessarily have a history in the dating back to the 1970s like the Sounders did. Now, another way to view it is maybe the Seattle ownership group wanted to name them the Sounders, but MLS was opposed to it at that point, and so they needed like the response from the fans to kind of prove it to MLS.
No, I'll tell you exactly what happened. It was the ownership group came in. They had nothing to do with the previous Sounders. They're like,
Adrian Hadar was part of the ownership group. He was the owner of the previous Sounders.
We need to establish ourselves as a new, interesting thing. But also, we want to make sure that we're in the soccer lineage, that people know that this is serious football. So we're going to call ourselves Seattle FC. That's how that conversation went.
Okay.
And then they were like, Sounders? And he was like, no. This is about starting anew.
Okay.
We put out two scenarios here. I'm telling you, whatever scenario it is more likely than them intentionally leaving the name that they wanted to have off just to get people to write it in. Because that could backfire very severely.
I'm looking at a fan poll from 2007 on an MLS message board. 61% of the voters picked Seattle Sounders.
Doesn't matter. Okay, anyway.
So their first signing.
We have to be very friendly about our arguments today. Oh,
no. Their first signing was Sebastian Letou. Who was playing for the USL Sounders, was the league MVP and helped the Sounders to the semifinals of the US Open Cup for the second consecutive years. They beat the Kansas City Wizards 6-5 on PKs in a quarterfinal win at Quest Field that we attended our second consecutive year.
Right? That was fun.
Yeah, it was. Before losing at fellow USL side Charleston Battery in the semis on PKs, partially because Charleston included a young man named Osvaldo Alonso.
Wow. There we go.
They announced the signing of Northwest soccer legend, Lacey native Casey Keller in August, coming back to U.S. after many years playing in Europe. October brought former Arsenal star Freddie Ljungberg as their first designated player. And then key expansion draft pickups included Brad Evans and James Riley. And then lastly, they concluded the group in December 2008 by introducing Ziggy Schmidt as their new head coach just months after he – or weeks probably after he had won the MLS Cup with the Columbus Crew.
Pretty wild.
Yeah.
I mean, they definitely started it off the right way, right, with Casey Keller, both a local product and who, you know, for casual fans like myself at the time, one of the few American soccer players who I was even familiar with.
Yep.
And so, I mean, he was coming over. He was at Fulham right before then, spent a bunch of years at Tottenham. Like, he was a big name far as international soccer players go. And then bringing him back was freaking huge. It was like, okay, we're in. They have Casey Keller. Like, this is happening. And you could just take the whole thing seriously right from that very beginning. Like, we didn't – and maybe I'm speaking for myself – had no idea who Freddie Ljungberg was at the time. But, like – He definitely seemed like the type of player who, if you paid a lot of attention to soccer internationally, you would have known.
Yeah, I mean, the people we knew who did follow it like that were excited about it from that standpoint. Also, the people who followed Calvin Klein ads.
I mean, he spent over a decade at Arsenal. Like, he was definitely not a no one when he came over.
No,
he scored two goals in the history of the Sounders. Wow.
I mean, he was never a huge goal scorer. That's not shocking, but he was definitely more of like the in the MLS style. Never really agreed with Ljungberg, but he was still really exciting when he got the ball at his feet with space to operate. That was very exciting. Okay, so one other thing we should talk about from 2008 before we get to music, and that is a little thing I like to call snowpocalypse.
Okay. I can't believe that was 2008.
There was so much snow. It was just really a lot of snow. That night that Cheryl Swoops picked me for the pickup game at the Furtado Center was the start of the big snowstorm.
Wow. An interesting wrinkle to the story.
And you were like, oh, it's not actually going to snow. They're just making this up. You taunted the snow. And then it snowed so much. Yes.
I taunted the snow?
Yeah. This is saved and recorded in our fantasy football blog.
Oh, God. I hope that's been deleted from the internet. Heartbreaking work of fantasy football genius.
Oh, it sure has not.
Oh, God. Let's not go ahead and link to that.
The Skilo bust is still here.
There's a Skilo post, and the Dave Eggers reference is really very nice. It snowed a lot. So I think what it was, I remember my work at the time, well, being like, we all stayed home for a day because it was supposed to snow, and then it just didn't snow. And then I remember my boss sending an email being like, this is snow, and it was like really coming down. And then it kind of just didn't go away for like unprecedented amount of time for Seattle, right? It was like two solid weeks where there was just – and it just kept snowing more. I remember there was one night. So it was December 20th because we were supposed to have a Starfucker and Natalie Portman-shaped head show at the Vero Project, which may come up later on Remember Some Years. And nice it was transition. Like crazy sold out, the show. And – it was supposed to be on December 20th, and it snowed so much, I was like, we have to cancel the show. Like, nobody is going to be able to get there. And I think that night, we both had a snow and freezing rain and windstorm. So I lived on a hill in Renton, like, literally on the, like, incline of a hill. And it winded so much that there are these big, like, hills of snow, so it like plume over, and then there's this thick layer of just ice on top. So I remember walking out into the snow, and you would crunch through like a layer of ice, and then there was the pack of snow underneath, and it was unlike anything we'd ever experienced in our lives beforehand. I mean, I never shoveled snow before 2008. This is the first time I ever shoveled snow.
Yep.
We also had a moment where Mrs. Fantasy Genius, I think there was like, I think this was December 23rd. So we're like right on the heels of Christmas. I'm like sleeping. She wakes me up. She's like, I have a bladder infection, like a really bad bladder infection. I need to go to the hospital right now. And again, living on a hill, not super convenient for driving during snowpocalypse. It was like 1 a.m. or whatever. And so we're in the car and driving down the hill. And the car, I just like lose control of the car. And this is, I don't know, a Chevy Lumina or a Toyota Camry or something. And it's just like swirling around and I'm hitting the brakes. And there was I completely lost control of the car. And there was a neighbor's house right down the street from us that had this huge edge, like a cliff, basically. And it was like 5 feet high and then a car below it into their house. And we stopped within 3 inches of that cliff. And then I was like, we're not going anywhere. we're not driving. This was like a foot of snow on the streets. And I was like, we're going to have to wait until tomorrow. And then we got out and had to deal with that later. I remember the next morning just shoveling the car out of snow and looking down and being like, thank God I did not drive my car into this neighbor's house. Like, that was – it was a crazy time.
Yes, it was. Also, I lost to Katie in the fantasy football final.
It was one of the few years that I was not in the fantasy football final.
So, Snowpocalypse and the Sonics moved 2008. Also, Greg Nichols, worst year ever.
Oh, God.
Let's talk about music.
Well, speaking of Snowpocalypse, actually, I remember, I have a distinct memory of Christmas Day. Miss Fantasy Genius still had the bladder infection. We actually went to the hospital or to the urgent care on Christmas morning. And you and all of our family were in Boulevard Park together, right? Because it was pretty convenient for you all to get together in the snow. I'm in Renton all alone, basically. And I left Mrs. Fantasy Genius at home for ravioli dinner on Christmas Day. And I remember driving through, like, braving the snow a little bit and driving to Grandma and Grandpa's house on Christmas Day to go eat ravioli. And I was listening to a band called Times New Viking at the time. Have you ever heard of them?
No.
Man, that record still slaps. Rock, they're like a noise band out of Columbus, Ohio, out of Columbus. And it was like noisy and abrasive, but also catchy. And I feel like that was a lot of like the 2008 sound. We were sort of moving past the more traditional indie rock that was happening beforehand, or the more, I would say, Baroque indie rock of the, like,
the more dad indie rock.
And into, there was, like, a Crosby, Stills, and Nash-inspired indie rock that was happening, and then also the, like, noisier end. And I remember listening to that, just, like, I always think of that drive there. But taking it back to the more, I guess, I don't know if this is really Crosby, Stills, Nash-like, a little bit more Paul Simon-like, but the Vampire Weekend, self-titled debut, 2008.
So there's been a lot of questions lately about, like, you know, challenges, I guess, about the albums with no skips on them. That Vampire Weekend debut, to me, stands out as one that is, like, front-to-back so strong.
Really? Self-titled? Yeah. Over Modern Vampires of the City?
Yeah, I think so.
Really? They were a weirdly tough band. I mean, I bought the CD at Easy Street Records. It was like $7.99 at Easy Street Records. I walked over from the Vera Project. I remember getting an email from Ezra Koenig while they were self-booking. Yeah, they were still. It was either him or Rostam, and they were self-booking a tour. And it was like,
save that.
I feel stupid for not. But they were nobody. I didn't book the show. I didn't even engage with it. It's like a vivid memory. I've tried to find it later on at bookingtheveraproject.org. And it was like, hey, we're this young rock band out of Columbia or something, putting out our new record and trying to tour. They didn't have an agent. Like, they were self-booking a tour. This is Vampire Weekend. And, like, there was steam behind the band. I should have booked the show. And I think at some point later, I mean, it just blew up instantly. for Vampire Weekend. It was people talking about like industry plants, but it was like Vampire Weekend was so, I mean, the debut record came out on XL. Like, they were destined to be successful extremely quickly.
Sadly, and this is in 2009, but this is your equivalent of me getting an email from Zach Lowe through like the Basketball Prospectus like email serve function.
It's funny because looking back on it now, in the year 2008, the thing that I regretted the most music-wise was a band called The Pains of Being Pure at Heart hit me up and they wanted to play the Vera Project stage at Capitol Block Party, and I didn't have the money to pay them for our budget that by like modern standards, when I think back on it now, should be for the entire weekend is less than one band should be paid. So I didn't have the money to pay them, and they ended up playing the main stage at Capitol Block Party, and I was devastated by this. And I was like, The Pains of Being Pure at Heart is the future of music. But yeah, definitely passed on a Vampire Weekend show in 2008. But who gives a fuck about an Oxford comma? So there was that one. Also in 2008, I remember, so I officially got hired booking the Vera Project January 1st, 2008. And February 15th, we had a show where, oh my God, what is the band called? Oh, fuck. The Pharmacy were headlining from Vashon Island. And this dude, the main member of the Pharmacy, Scotty, was like, hey, I asked my friends Fleet Foxes to open the show on February 15th. And I'm like, oh yeah, cool, I remember them. I'd reviewed Fleet Foxes, and a really negative review of Fleet Foxes.
Wait, really?
For the website that I was writing for before in 2007, mercurialsound.com, I shit on, they were opening for Matt Costa at the Crocodile. So Fleet Foxes had an early EP out before the Sun Giant EP came out. And they opened for Matt Costa at the Crocodile. And I remember shitting on them and just being like, they're very good looking. And me and Jan went to it. Jan, it was a pretty hip thing for Jan to have been at this Fleet Foxes show so early on. So anyway, the Pharmacy were like, we booked our friends Fleet Foxes to open the show. And I'm like, oh, cool, I remember them. And there was a Stranger article that had come out like a week beforehand. And at the time, I had never seen ticket sales increase so quickly. And it was just like a switch flipped. And it was like, all of a sudden, every single person in Seattle discovered Fleet Foxes. And we're like, this is going to take over Seattle music. And then by, I think, that April, they had signed to Sub Pop already. they played the Vera stage at Capitol Block Party the previous year. But they'd signed to Sub Pop. And the EP that really broke them, the Sun Giant EP, had come out, I think, that April of 2008. Yeah, April 8th, 2008. Sun Giant EP came out. And it's just like, the Fleet Foxes self-titled that came out that summer, I'm a fan of. The EP is 18 minutes and 50 seconds of perfect music.
That's interesting, because I would put that, the self-titled debut, right there with the Vampire Weekend. It is, again, front to back, so solid.
There was something about, and I think they eventually bundled them together, but like the Sun Giant EP, to me, was just like, this band is, there are those moments when, I think they recorded that on Vashon, actually. I know they recorded it at Bear Creek. There are moments where I'm like,
oh, well, there's a review of you from the Rolling Stones here on Mercurial Sound.
Oh, God. I reviewed the Rolling Stones.
The Rolling Stones are like a friend that you stopped hanging out with in 1981.
Why do you have to find my reviews? That's still up, Mercurial Sound? Are you using the Wayback Machine again?
I sure am, buddy. Why did you have to have some bad takes in 2006? Like,
well, did I have negative?
That's the real question. Lately, though, we've been asking them to come over for a cup of tea more often than any other time in the last 25 years before now. I guess this did turn positive. Okay.
But the Rolling Stones?
Yeah.
I would hope so. Good God. but that EP was perfect. And then the full length came out. Not quite as good as the EP, but also, like, it's one of those things where you're just like, how am I living 20 minutes from where this music is being recorded? Like, music that is just like
so fucking timeless. I'm like, there is a person so close to me recording these harmonies that are going to last for centuries. I just feel like it was almost like, and then into that, like, I also, like, got to know very mildly Robin Pecknold and the basically the whole band around that time period. And it was like, I just can't even believe these people. And it all blew up so fast. I mean, there was a Sasquatch that year where there was some band that couldn't make it through the border, and Fleet Foxes were playing on like a secondary stage, and this band couldn't make it through the border. I can't remember who it was. And then they just had Fleet Foxes play the main stage too.
About Tristan.
Oh God. Why?
I like Entourage a lot. And that this guy from the Sprite commercials.
Well, Thirst from the Sprite commercials does still hold up.
True. It stood the test of time. 2006.
Oh God! Look, we're talking in 2008 here. Okay.
I know, but that's when that was that this would bio was written was 2006.
Jesus Christ!
When you were age 2, lowercase o. Okay, more 2006 music or 2007 music.
Stay Positive by the Hold Steady. I was not like a huge Boys and Girls in America fan. It's fine, but the first few seconds of Constructive Summer, the first song on Stay Positive, there's talking about getting drunk on top of water towers, like raise a toast to St. Joe Strummer, and I was just like, we're fucking back. It was like, I think it came out that summer, and it was definitely, it was the theme to drinking heavily that summer, and that's what the Hold Steady were all about.
Sounds constructive.
Alopecia by Y. I don't know if you've ever listened to this record.
I don't think I have, no.
Number one vibraphone record of the year. this is Yoni Wolf's Y from Cincinnati. And it's still to this day, I will always ride for this album. Like, every second, his, like, very, like, self-aware sort of rapping, sort of singing, these, like, dense moments that build into, like, vibraphone jams. It was definitely the perfect moment of why the beginning of Beach House. We have Nouns by No Age, where I was talking about things getting noisy, but like the debut full length on Sub Pop by No Age. And it was like, this was that DIY scene that I was talking about last episode of Let's Remember Some Years. And it all of a sudden had become kind of professional. It's like, oh, this is like I remember seeing a No Age video on some sort of version of 120 minutes or whatever, an MTV show. And I was like, whoa, man. I was like, this band's going to be massive. And then of course the most important record to come out in 2008. Do you know what that is?
I'm not sure where you're going with this exactly.
808s and Heartbreaks.
Okay. That's what I assumed, but I didn't know if you were being ironic there.
Without 808s and Heartbreaks, there doesn't happen, like, probably, like, a decade of music after. To this day, I'd be, you know, like, artists like Post Malone, Tyler, the Creator, Kid Cudi, who was affiliated with that, but, like, really broke because of it. I just do not think the whole generation of rap music that happened after it, you know, like, Odd Future in general, I think was this album was so important for what they were doing. And it was like dark and cynical and auto-tuned. And it was like, I think the next summer Jay-Z did Death of Auto-Tune. And it was like, you're an old man now, Jay-Z. Like, auto-tune is not going away. Kanye did it on this record and it is still to this day here to stay. And it's like 808s and Heartbreaks was probably more so than any other Kanye record, the most like long-term groundbreaking and influential. If there was like a Velvet Underground Kanye record, it's 808s and Heartbreaks more than it is anything else.
Mm-hmm.
You probably never listened to it.
No, I hadn't really listened to the whole album until, I mean, obviously I've listened to like the singles off of it, but when I listened to
Poor Little LA Girl,
In 2020, it was the first time.
In 2020. Do you feel like you hear some of what I'm talking about, though?
It's pretty subtle, but yes.
I mean, like, Flower Boy by Tyler Crater just does not happen without 808s and Heartbreaks. Any other albums that stand out to you from 2008?
Well, we got to talk about The Recession by Jeezy. If only for the song, My President is Black. Which I didn't realize didn't come out before after the election. For some reason, I had just assumed that that song with Nas came out after the election, but it came out on the day that Obama secured the Democratic nomination.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was a campaign song and a correct prognostication.
We should talk about the election in a second. Okay, I wanted to say, 2008, first ever.
You're talking about it now?
Oh, wait, this is 2009 that I have up. Fuck me. All right, we're going to come back to that.
Oh God. I mean, there's a couple other things musically we should mention.
What is that?
Well, Halo is maybe the best Beyonce song.
Okay.
Even though I Am Sasha Fierce is definitely not the best Beyonce album.
I feel like that one's sort of been lost in time.
It's her most played song on Spotify.
Really? No, the album, not the song.
Oh, yeah.
The I Am Sasha Fierce.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. Like, especially because the Sasha Fierce concept definitely did not go on.
When I saw that, I was just like, what? Okay. Capitol Block Party 2008. Wait, I have to find this poster. Okay, here we go. So the lineup of Capitol Block Party. Headlining, we have Vampire Weekend. Ever heard of them? I mean, that's how quickly this happened for Vampire Weekend. That they, wow, the Kenya Dawson moment happened in Juno happened in 2008. Is that right? Vampire Weekend, The Hold Steady, Lasavi Fav, Girl Talk. So Girl Talk had moved from Numas to this year. He was on the main stage. Chromeo, Kimia Dawson, USE, The Dodos. So this Capitol Block Party, it was the first ever time that I had booked a stage at Capitol Block Party. Next week, I'm going to talk about how great my stage was. But before the festival had opened, me and third Pelton brother Reese, God, I was such a little shit. At 23 what? Years old, it was just like ridiculous that this, I felt like this was a reasonable thing to do. So I booked the stage. Other people were running the stage, so I was not like being negligent work-wise, but I'd gotten it all set or whatever. I went up to the production person for Capitol Block Party and was like, do you know where there's a liquor store? And then he pointed me out the liquor store that's in Capitol Hill. And I can't even believe that I thought that that was a reasonable thing to do at like 10 a.m. on a Friday before Block Party. We were so hyped on the Hold Steady that summer that we got a fifth of Dark Bacardi, which they sing about on an earlier song, drank the entire bottle of liquor in or around my car, parked like basically where the garage is, I think, now. And
I mean, I remember the garage existed then, didn't it?
I guess it was a block up from there toward Block Party and a block north of the garage. So I remember Chris Smith shows up and here's like these drunk motherfuckers at like 3 p.m. or whatever. And then so he came and hang out. We drank an entire fifth of alcohol before the festival even opened that year. My first ever day of having booked a stage at a fucking music festival, because I should have never been given that responsibility as a 23-year-old or whatever, a 22, 23-year-old, and locked my keys in the car because we were just fucking wasted. And Reese has talked about this on a Pelton cast before. locked my keys in the car. Had to call a locksmith to get them to open my car. Finally, the Hold Steady are playing.
we're in the like front row screaming along. Reese gets kicked out of the festival for puking in the porta potties in the VIP area and sneaks back in and is in the photo pit. I remember being in like the front row, like yelling along or whatever, being like getting drunk on top of water towers. And then there's Reese in the photo pit and I'm like, how the hell are you here? Or whatever. But yeah, that was my first ever day of booking a music festival.
There you go. Whew,
should not have had that kind of responsibility as a 23-year-old. Anyway, that was music in 2008.
Well, wait, are we going to check out a bumper shoot?
I didn't pull up the bumper shoot lineup.
Granted, you weren't blogging. We did discover the bumper vlog from 2008.
Oh, God.
And what a bumper vlog it was.
I actually felt like looking back on it, I was like, some of this stuff, this is not as bad as I would have expected.
Okay, right? So we've got Death Cab headlining one night. Death Cab that year with I Will Possess Your Heart.
So okay.
It's all a strong year for Death Cab.
I really don't even remember this bummer shoot at all. I think I'd fully transitioned to Block Party being my number one festival. Like Stone Temple Pilots played.
Yeah, it's starting to become kind of a weird lineup.
Wait until I get involved.
Oh no.
Then I'm going to be taking credit for Stone Temple Pilots playing. Man, I know that I went to Bumbershoot for, like, so many straight years. I do not remember a single... This might have been the year that I went for, like, 5 minutes. There was one Bumbershoot.
Seattle PI reports Bumbershoot 2008, the best mid-90s Lollapalooza lineup ever.
Oh, damn. That sounds like me writing the Bumber blog about it. I do not remember seeing any of these artists. Beck, Stone Temple Pilots, Death Cab, T.I. played apparently, don't recall that. The Offspring, Keisha Cole, Lucinda Williams, Paramore, Nico Case, Band of Horses. I mean, it's not bad. There was one bummer shoot that I went and got passes to see Aziz Ansari do stand up because you had to go get passes early. And then I was trying to go back to go see Aziz Ansari. And ended up not making it in time. And I think that was the entirety of my bummer shoot. And that might have been 2008. But also I might have been involved in booking by 2009.
We're still a year ahead of the big Aziz Ansari breakout, so we'll get to that next year. Anything else on music in 2008?
No, I think that's it. I'm gonna take my Block Party victory lap next week. I thought it was going to be this week, but I'll come back to that.
So the big TV debut of 2008 was a little show called Breaking Bad. What I like to call a sequel. Now I forgot the name of the show.
Wow. Better Call Saul?
Yes.
Is that what you're thinking? I did not watch Breaking Bad in 2008.
I vaguely remember seeing like an early part of like one of the early episodes because I'm not sure what I would have been watching before it exactly. But I'm being like, this is weird. Why is the dad from Malcolm in the Middle doing here?
Dr. Whatley? Tim Watley's made good on himself. I had the same experience where I'd like come home and watched like 20 minutes on AMC or whatever of like a season one episode, and I had no context whatsoever for what it was. And then eventually when I actually started watching the show, probably a year later, I was like, oh yeah, I had kind of like deja vu for a second. Where I was like, this is that show. We also didn't talk about Mad Men in 2007. This was quite a good era for prestige TV. And
I did miss that one. Yeah, that's a bad miss.
We both definitely were still watching Entourage.
I mean, You have to watch that all the way through to the finale.
Yeah, you gotta see when Vince buys dinosaur bones or something.
I believe it was a dinosaur egg.
A dinosaur egg. Yeah, that was a plot point. And Adrian Peterson wanted it.
That sounds about right.
When you search Mad Men, people also ask, what is wrong with Don Draper?
Oh, they were buying that a skull of an Allosaurus, apparently.
Oh, yeah. That happens. 2008 in film.
Yeah. Semi-pro, which I recall we... Were you there? The Sonics did a screening of that.
Absolutely, I was there.
Yeah.
You know, that's really the thing. The team moved, but... The part you really forget is not the basketball. The part that you really miss is not the basketball. It's the sneak previews of the movie Semi-Pro starring Will Ferrell and Andre Benjamin.
A movie that I had not watched in well over a decade before watching it early in the quarantine at the recommendation of my friend Zach Harper.
Recommendation of Harper? Because I watched this like about the same time probably as you. Harper actually did not recommend it to me.
I mean, you recommended it on Twitter. It's not like he like came to me and was like, Kevin, here's what you need to watch.
I was shocked how bad this movie was. Did you have the same response?
I thought it was better than I remembered, because I remember really? It being very bad.
One of the plot points is that Woody Harrelson is really good at basketball.
I mean, it's a comedy.
There's just like...
Also, I don't know if you're aware of this. Woody Harrelson is in arguably the greatest basketball movie of all time.
I guess that is true. He just like the semi-pro version of Woody Harrelson is just like...
He was very old by 2008. It was very old.
Also, like, by modern standards, it's kind of crazy how, you know, 2008 wasn't that long ago, but like the language is just like, there's so many things that I'm like, whoa, man, that is offensive by modern standards. In Semi-Pro or whatever, like listening to it, I was like, these jokes are not okay anymore.
I mean, it is also a period piece of the 1970s. It's not like it was set in 2008.
It was set in the 1970s, but it was also set in 2008.
Fair.
And there was not enough Andre Benjamin.
There's plenty of Andre Benjamin. Who? Okay, so the another movie I remember going to see in the theaters... 21.
Oh yeah.
Maybe the single worst movie I've ever seen in the theater.
Oh man, you have a good
really
boys and girls on your first ever date. Wow. Starring Jason Biggs.
But, I haven't. That's true.
You really think that movie was that bad? MGMT.
Yes. The soundtrack was good. Yes, I said like that album, the MGMT album, came out in 2007. But I wanted to save it to talk about it here because it was such a like big moment to be in that movie. But I really liked the book Bringing Down the House.
Oh yeah, we loved it. Was so short.
it was
the perfect length for a non-reader.
It was a page turner, but then they like turned all the Asian characters white. It was like very Hollywood in 2008.
Did they really?
Oh yeah.
Wow.
I mean, Jeff Ma was like the key guy in that book, right?
Wait, the main character of 21 was white?
Yeah.
Wow. Oh boy. Man. There aren't enough MGMTs in the world to make that okay.
Oh no, there definitely are. Okay, also in 2008. A big year for comedies, I would say. We've got Forgetting Sarah Marshall.
The Jason Segel vehicle, right? This is peak Segel.
You could argue peak Apatow. So you've got Step Brothers and then Pineapple Express.
And I think for me personally, I was a little bit out of these comedies by this point, and maybe it was as a byproduct of getting slightly older and out of college, but it was like a lot of these films I hadn't seen. I didn't see Step Brothers until like 3 months ago for the first time ever.
Wait, really?
Yeah,
I didn't see Pineapple Express until last week.
I've seen Pineapple Express like maybe like half watched it one time.
or whatever. Like, the, and it's funny because all of these people who are in these films, I was so in on, especially like, I probably watched Freaks and Geeks for the first time in 2008. And it was like, I went through and watched all Freaks and Geeks and all of Undeclared around this time period. And then I really liked Forgetting Sarah Marshall, but it's like, I never really cared about Pineapple Express. And I probably just like read critic reviews of Step Brothers or whatever, and it didn't hit right away. It's funny because Adam Scott is one of the funniest characters in it, and I've been a Scott stan since the mid-90s, right?
Since his turn is...
Griff?
It's not... Griff, I was going to say Grinch, but yeah, Griff, yeah.
You're just reading that Bumber blog and thinking about Grinch. Yeah, stole the show. On the mind. It was like, Adam Scott is a tour de force in Step Brothers.
That's correct.
Having not seen that, this Adam Scott performance, I was really missing out on something for more than a decade. But this was sort of like, this was the tail end. Like this was not the peak, but, and I'm sure for a lot of people, like these were the number one films for them from this time period. But it was like, for us, I feel like it was more old school into Anchorman and things like that. And this was like, correct. Oh, okay. Like, by the time you got to semi-pro, I was like, Will Ferrell's, it's falling off a little bit.
A little bit. I think that we were disappointed by semi-pro because our expectations were still pretty high going into it.
I also think there was maybe some exhaust from these films where it's like, if you put out there's so much that's coming out like boom, 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 2004 through 2008. And it was like, all of a sudden you get to like this point, you're just like, damn, we have seen so much stuff in the same sort of genre by this point that it was like, we'd had our period or whatever. And this almost was like a whole new generation's period, even though it's only 4 years.
Yeah.
So it for whatever reason, like 2008 was not the right time period for me. But now I'm like, damn, Step Brothers is a classic film.
The sing-along? Anything else on 2008?
What a year.
It was a year. So there's not really any Seattle sports news. There's very little this week. We mentioned the Marshawn thing. The Seahawks also on Monday waived Nazir Jones to make room for signing undrafted free agents coming out of the last month's NFL draft. That was also new to me, because I got to be honest, I thought we had waived Nas Jones last year. I didn't realize he was just on IR the whole time.
It is kind of funny. I was going through that list of defensive linemen with Zach, who the Seahawks had on roster, and Nas Jones' name did not come up. But the time that he had a pick six against Aaron Rodgers, that should have counted. Again, worst call in sports history. Aside, I'm telling you, that was a terrible call. That's a pick six.
It wasn't a good call. I bet there were some Packers fans who would argue it was not the worst call in a Packers-Seahawks game in the past decade. Pretty sure about that.
But this was definitely a byproduct of just there being so much depth on the defensive line. You know, Nas Jones is more of an interior player, which they don't have quite the same amount of depth at as they do on the outside, but it's just, there's going to be attrition here, and there's going to be players who are going to have slightly bigger names who are going to be released because you just can't play everybody.
I mean, to me, it said more about the fact that just the coaching staff and the organization wasn't as high on him as the fans were, you know, during his second season and then going into last season, coming off the strong rookie campaign.
But
so the NFL...
No, it's just sad to see Nas Jones go. We'll still love Nas Jones. He'll be back on the team eventually, I'm sure.
It does happen. I mean, Quentin Jefferson, you had a similar story, I guess, among many, many others. But Quentin Jefferson, in terms of like someone who was relatively early in their career and came back quickly.
I was going to say, Quentin Jefferson is the one you picked out, huh? Not the two on the defensive line that the Seahawks signed this offseason.
I'm just saying, like, in terms of, like, he wasn't gone very long and then came back.
Yeah.
The NFL set to release the schedule on Thursday, which is exciting because there will definitely be a 2020 NFL season.
I'm pretty fascinated how this is going to go. I mean, like, we're just going to march forward and people will analyze it as if this is going to be the schedule. And
I mean, you kind of have to. Like, I don't know what the alternative is.
I think at the very least, this will be what we will see is the order in which the games will be played.
I mean, there's some speculation that the NFL will seek to balance the schedule home and away over the first 2 and 4 weeks, so as to open up the possibility, if those games need to be canceled, that they can still play a balanced schedule.
Okay.
So, it'll be interesting.
I think there's a good chance that these games, I would say there's an extremely high chance that the games are played without fans. And I would not, they will probably have dates attached to them right now, but I would not be shocked if the NFL sought ways to spread the schedule out throughout the week, where we saw, I mean, college seems even more unlikely to happen than the NFL, because the incentives aren't really there in the same way that they are in the NFL, aside for the coaches, of course, and the campuses, not the players, but it's just the college is so sprawling in a way that the NFL isn't. And having a situation where you were to have all teams set up in 4 or 5, 2 to 3 locations, whatever, it's just not a reasonable solution in college. So they could lose Saturdays altogether for the season. And we could see a number of games where it's like almost every game becomes a national TV game in the NFL, where you have the Thursday game already, and then you have 3 games every Saturday and a chunk of games every Sunday and maybe multiple games on Monday. Like, I think for this season, if it were to happen, I think there's a very good chance that every game becomes a national TV game or close to it. I mean, we could see games Thursday through Monday.
It'd be an interesting possibility.
And, I mean, they'll do great.
I mean, I think everything's on the table right now.
Yes. The thing, not everything is on the table, because I really do not think that just the schedule going off as they announce it with fans at all these stadiums being on the table, I do not see that happening.
It is exceedingly optimistic.
That is, the schedule being played as it's announced is actually the least likely outcome.
But we're sure going to announce it anyway.
You gotta dominate that news cycle. The news cycle ain't gonna dominate itself.
That's true, very true. On that note, we managed to get through this entire podcast without getting into a knockdown, dragout fight.
It's too bad you agreed with me about the schedule.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.